your shelf together with eShaver Booksellers.
Hello, I'm Jessica, a lifelong lover of books, wide-ranging reader, fan of obscure British literature, all things Douglas Adams, long sentences, music biographies, the Oxford comma, always up for travel, except during COVID, and of course, Jane Austen.
And I'm Melissa, an eclectic bibliophile and all-around nerd who also loves Jane Austen, comics, and cooking. Together, we run an independent bookstore in Savannah, Georgia. Each episode, we discuss the books we've been reading and recommend.
Well, hello, everyone.
Hello.
It's January.
It's January 8,035. January is the month that will not end.
Well, that's fine because I'm actually not looking forward to a lot of February. Well, I am looking forward to it. That's not true. But we have a lot going on in February.
We do have a lot going on in February. But, you know, there was a lot going on in January, too. Like a unexpected snowstorm.
Yes.
That shut Savannah down for days.
Yeah. We got a whole 3.2 inches downtown.
Yeah, of snow. But then there was also ice.
Days of ice. Yes. So there was a lot of sort of ice skating around downtown, trying to get down there to feed the cats and make sure everything was okay.
And, you know, the South, not exactly equipped for dealing with snowstorms. And
yes, I did try salting the sidewalk, but apparently my efforts were fruitless in the amount of snow that fell.
Yeah.
So anyway, we are now snow free, mostly in Savannah. There are little pockets of it left.
Yeah.
And I think we'll be ready for it again in about 5 or 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's beautiful.
It is. It's just inconvenient.
Yes. There you go. There you go. But anyway, it did give us a chance to read a little bit, mm-hmm. sort of, and that was fun.
Yeah.
So what have you been reading, Melissa?
All kinds of things. So the first thing I was going to talk about actually doesn't come out until May, but I really, really loved it. And this mm-hmm. book is getting a ton of buzz already. So I just wanted to put it on everybody's radar. It's called The Names by Florence mm-hmm. Knapp.
Oh, it is in my pile. There's just one thing in front of it that I have to read because I promised I would.
Well, so I had gotten a package at the shop from Pamela Dorman Books, mm-hmm. which is the imprint that is publishing this book, wanting to create sort of a bookseller panel where they would send early release copies to, and then we would discuss the big titles and things that they're excited about. Mm-hmm. And this was the first book that they sent me. And I would say ordinarily, like, it has a great cover, but ordinarily it is not the kind of book that I would necessarily be drawn to or would have picked up on my mm-hmm. own. But because they asked me to read it, I was like, yeah, sure. I loved this book. I thought this yeah. book was brilliant. So it starts with a woman named Cora. Her husband is a doctor. And they have a 9-year-old daughter, and they have a new son. And Cora is supposed to go and have the son's name officially registered. Mm-hmm. And the father, Gordon, is very insistent that he be named after him. So he wants the child to be named Gordon.
Mm-hmm.
She does not, for a myriad of reasons, one of which being that Gordon is both physically, verbally, mentally abusive to her. And
she doesn't want to do that to her kid.
Right. She doesn't want to have the kid have the same name and him be kind of stuck in this pattern, mm-hmm. right? And I will say that if you are sensitive to descriptions of domestic violence, this might not be the book for you because it is talked about a lot, and she does describe it,
mm-hmm.
what's happening. It's not just allusions to, like, actual what is happening. So just a caveat. So she wants to name her son a different name. And then as she and her daughter are walking to go register the name, mm-hmm. the daughter has a suggestion for a name for her brother.
Mm-hmm.
And so the book, then she goes to register, and then the book does sort of a what if. And so it follows three different alternate versions in which she names the son each of the names. Okay. And so then you follow the story of Cora, her son, the family, what happens in each of these instances. And it's kind of asking, like, does a name determine mm-hmm. your destiny? And it's really, really interesting. It's really well done. The different versions, there are little things mm-hmm. and people in each one that show up in the others, but not in the same way. And it just...
Interesting.
It's yeah. really kind of mind-blowingly good for a mm-hmm. debut novel. Like, just yeah. so good. So it's The Names by Florence Knapp. And I don't want to say any more about it because it really is, like, just propulsive, like you mm-hmm. need to know what happens. And it will be out in May. So well, definitely keep that one on your radar.
Yeah. And I'm looking forward to reading it too. And we can discuss it a little
sure.
further. I'm excited about that. So I recently read, I've been wanting to read this forever and I've started it, but not been able to get into it because I had other commitments, because it's a chunk of a book. I mean, it's not huge, huge, but it weighs in at, I'm looking, how many pages? A little shy of 500 pages. So, yeah. It's Tana French's new book, The Hunter. It's just come out in paperback, actually, so it's not that new, which is the second in the series that follows up The Searcher. So she's left her Dublin crime procedurals that was her main series and gone into this new series. And the main character is Cal, and he's this tough, you know, but kind-hearted retired police officer from Chicago who wanted to move to the west of Ireland to have a peaceful life.
You know what? I feel him.
Yeah. He just wanted to go... get away from everything. He bought a little cottage with a little bit of land. He loves woodworking. He has enough in his pension to be retired. He can't work over there because he doesn't have a work visa, but he does some on-the-side woodworking, furniture repairs, carpentry, and stuff.
I imagine he's probably going to do some on-the-side policing as well.
Well, it happens in this tiny village that doesn't really exist, but is in the west of Ireland, that... there are a fair amount of bachelor farmers, older people, younger people are moving out. There's not industry there.
It's so like people the West Virginia of Ireland.
Yeah. I mean, it's beautiful and picturesque.
That's what I'm saying.
But it has some issues that he was not equipped for. So in the first book, The Searcher, he meets up with this kid who starts coming to his house. Everyone immediately figures out that he's a retired cop in the village, like just immediately. They're like, you're a Garda. So anyway, his cover is blown on that. So they kind of are suspicious of him at first, but then he gets drawn in through this kid, Trey, who he initially thinks is a young boy, but is revealed in the first book is actually a girl pretty early in. And he takes Trey under his wing and becomes very paternal and protective of her, but in a careful way, because the villagers also will talk if he spends too much time alone with her. So when we get to the second book, he's been in the village for several years. He has a girlfriend, and they have a nice arrangement. And the girlfriend is from there. She's a widow, and she has also taken on kind of looking after Trey and knows Trey's family situation, which is not great, and was years ago friends with Trey's mother. And so when we get to the second book, you know, things are quiet, but we're in the middle of this absolutely broiling summer, which sets the tone for the whole book, because Western Ireland is not known for its broiling summers.
No.
And so they're having a drought, there hasn't been rain, and there's this sort of atmospheric tension in the air. And as this is happening... Trey's dad, who's been gone forever, not forever, but for the past 10 to 15 years, just leaving his family, rolls back into town after having been in London. And he's got all these tails and fancy clothes. And Trey is immediately suspicious, as is her mother and pretty much everyone else in town, because they know him.
Mm-hmm.
And but they're kind of Southern, Midwestern, or Irish nice to him. They're like, oh, yes, so good to see you. But they're all like, what's going down? And he brings in this friend of his who's supposed to be a long-lost relative from the town that he's just happened to meet in London, whose grandmother was from this town. And so the friend comes into town. He's this supposedly posh Englishman, and he has this big tale about how his grandmother always told him there was gold in the hills, and that he bets that they can find the gold, and it goes from there. Mm-hmm. And everyone is suspicious, but everyone's also playing a double game in the book. Mm-hmm. And I just love her writing. I'm not going to go any further into the mystery than that because it'll ruin it. That's just all set up in the beginning of the book. But ultimately, it's a really slow burn until you hit about the middle of the book, and then you just have to know what's happening because you're so involved. The way she writes, you end up being so involved in these characters' lives that they seem real. And I started it and it took me a day or so. And then I got to the second part of the book and I just did nothing else all day and sat there and finished it. And,
sure.
But I just love the way she writes. And it's interesting. There's one review I read that said, you know, even after I finished reading this, sometimes I'll catch myself thinking, I wonder how Cal's doing, or I wonder how Trey's doing, or I wonder what's that. You know, they almost become, you know, how some characters become kind of a part of your background.
Mm-hmm.
And so I highly recommend it. You can read them out of order, but I think the book makes more sense if you read The Searcher first and then read this one, because Trey has a lot of anger, which is well-founded towards the town. But if you haven't read the first book, you really don't understand the depth of her anger and why she is so against becoming a part of the town.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they're trying to kind of protect her, she knows what they're capable of. And I also love Tana French's books, not only for her fabulous writing, but because they're, instead of being straightforward police procedurals, there is a level of gray in this small town about what people do and the consequences of it. Mm-hmm. I think it's actually more realistic to what happens in the real world. Mm-hmm. And so I would highly recommend The Hunter by Tana French, which is now out in paperback. So you can get a paperback copy of it or hardcover. And if you read The Searcher, you absolutely have to read it. And I just hope she keeps on with this because I need more of these characters.
So the next thing that I have is also a mystery, but uh-huh. sort of a fun, kind of kooky, sort of Scooby-Doo kind of mystery.
Yeah, well, that's nice.
So it's called Grave Expectations by Alice Bell. And so the main character in the story is named Claire. And Claire works as a medium or a clairvoyant and does seances and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And she is hired to be the entertainment at the birthday party of the matriarch of this landed English family at their mm-hmm. country home. And the person that hires her actually went to college with Claire. So they know each other briefly, mm-hmm. but not very well. And so it turns out that Claire actually can see and talk to ghosts.
Mm-hmm.
She has a ghost companion that is kind of always with her. And her ghost companion is a 17-year-old girl named Sophie.
Mm-hmm.
And Sophie and Claire were best friends when they were teenagers. And Sophie went missing and died. And all of a sudden, Claire could see her ghost and speak to her.
Okay.
And Sophie has been with her ever since. And
so is she going to shed some light on Sophie's disappearance, or has she, or
not in this book? Like, there's allusions to her going missing. And mm-hmm. then, like, because Sophie doesn't know what happened to her. She doesn't remember it. So so Claire doesn't know because Sophie doesn't know. But Sophie works with Claire and is the reason that her seances are so successful and people believe them, because when she goes to the house, Sophie goes around the house and does all this recon and looks at photos and like digs into people's stuff and then is telling her all these secrets about these people that she couldn't possibly know. So when she's doing these seances, it seems like she knows all this stuff, right?
Okay.
So she's, like I said, been hired to be the entertainment at this birthday party. So they get to...
Adult birthday party, not children's, surely.
It's an 80-year-old woman.
Okay. Because that's really not where I would go.
The matriarch of the family. So Nana is having her 80th birthday party. They get to the country house. The family's all there. It's the day before the party, but the family asks for Claire to do a seance just for them to see what it's going to be like. So she does it, and... they're all a little skeptical. Some of them are, think it's kind of cool, but none of them believe that it's actually real. So cut to the next day. Nana has died overnight.
Oh, no.
And Nana's ghost appears to Claire and is like, look, there is a ghost that is haunting the library in this house, and I'm pretty sure one of the people in my family killed this person. I need you to figure it out since you can see ghosts.
Oh, cool.
And so leaves her with that.
And then
disappears. Like because I'm her done. Her business is done. She she goes off. And so the ghost that is haunting the library, you can't just figure out who it is because of how they look, because in the book, if someone has died by like traumatic means, like they've been murdered, they don't appear as like a corporeal ghost. They appear as like a skeleton, like sort of. So you can't just look at them and be like, oh, it's that person. And so
can they tell you who they are?
No, because they like the ghost is like doesn't have a connection to. They're just haunting the space. They don't really aren't able to connect.
Okay.
Because of the trauma of their death.
Okay.
So Claire and Sophie are going to solve this mystery with the help of two of the members of the family. So it's a guy and then their brother's child, who's non-binary in the book.
Okay.
So the people from the family don't necessarily believe that Claire can in fact speak to ghosts. So it's like they're going through this whole thing and they don't really necessarily believe that someone has been killed. And they're not sure if she's trying to con them and what the con would be. But it ends up being, like I said, sort of a Scooby-Doo sort of mystery, because you've got this ragtag group of people who are trying to solve this mystery. And it's just funny. I mean,
so kind of a Knives Out.
That sort of feeling. I thought it was a lot of fun. There's a second book in the series that I've not read yet. That's called Displeasure Island. If you want, it's sort of, I would say, funny, almost cozy adjacent mystery, that, you know, it has the nice British setting, like the country home and all that kind of stuff. So it's called Grave Expectations by Alice Bell.
Very nice. Well, for something different, although I have another mystery to come back to in a minute, but for something different, I just picked up this very slim little book called A Florence Diary that's been sitting on my shelf since 2017.
That's when it was an advanced reading copy.
It was an advanced reading copy in 2017. And, you know, we all have good intentions, but I've been listening to a lot of books, and I just really needed a print book in my hand this weekend when it was icy and couldn't really get outside. And so I picked up a couple of slim books that I could just finish in one sitting. And this was one of them. And it has taken me down a rabbit hole. And now I have a whole bunch of other things I want to read. Mm-hmm. So it's Diana Athill, and it's a Florence diary. And, you know, I in background, I knew a little bit about Diana Athill, but not that much. And she is fascinating. So this is her diary from her trip that her mother asked her to write for her. And it's right after the war, and she and one of her cousins go to Florence for a holiday. And so she takes notes the whole way about her travel over there, how amazing it is to be traveling again after the war, and then sort of their adventures when they're in Florence. And that's all it is. It's beautifully written and very engaging, and you can read it in one sitting. And it gives you a good idea of what her voice is like. She's written several other memoirs now, which I want to read because her life was fascinating. She worked for Andre, and I'm going to pronounce his name wrong, but it's a publisher, Deutsch, who had a publishing house, and she worked as one of his editors and with him, and she edited Philip Roth, Norman Mailer, John Updike, Mordecai Richer, Simon de Beauvoir?
Simone de Beauvoir?
Simone de Beauvoir. Oh. Jean Rhys, she did the...
Weitzer, yes, I see.
Yeah. So, I mean, just... And Brian Moore and a whole list. Jack Kerouac. So she... And Margaret Atwood. Mm-hmm. So she's fascinating. And she lived to be... I think 101. She was born in 1917 and died in 2019. So 101. And there's actually a really great documentary about her and her, I think, her last book, what was it? It's just about being old and, oh, I'm still sitting around waiting to die. And
sounds uplifting.
But she never married. She was engaged during the war to a pilot who went to Egypt, and then he just stopped writing back to her, and then he ended up marrying someone else. She was pretty roughly jilted, and she never married after that, really. She had a series of very interesting affairs and lovers, one of which committed suicide in her flat. I've just gone on a complete rabbit hole looking into her life, and I can't... She kind of reminds me of, like, the craziness of the Mitfords. Like, you just can't make a life like this up.
Sure.
And so now I want to read a couple of her memoirs to know more about her, because she's touched a lot of the works that I love. And so anyway, if you just want a little... introduction into her with a low time commitment, but a really good read. And if you've been to Florence, it's also a wonderful travel journal about being in Florence. I would highly recommend Diana Athill. It's absolutely fascinating.
All right.
Sorry. My dog is moving her bed around. So if you hear some gentle scruffing, that's what it is. It's never in the right place.
Well, sure, the sunbeam moves.
Well, and now we want to be closer to us.
Well, sure. Yeah. So the next thing I was going to talk about, so when we went to England this last time, mm-hmm. and went to the Jane Austen Festival, one of the things that we did at the Jane Austen Festival was go to a lecture given by a guy named John Mullen, and the lecture was on dialogue in Jane Austen's works, and it was fascinating, and he mm-hmm. did a great job, and I very much enjoyed it. And at the end he was saying, if you want to buy copies of my book, I have some of those here that I can sign for you.
And we didn't.
No. I had already bought this book the last time we were in England, because I saw it in a bookshop and I was like, this looks great. And I was like, okay, now I need I need to move this up on my reading. So I put it on the list of books for our Jane Austen book club this year. The book is called What Matters in Jane Austen, and it was really great. I think it's probably the best literary criticism book that mm-hmm. I've ever read, just in the things that he chooses to talk about and also just the readability of it. I mean, it's not like stuffily academic.
His lecture was really good,
yeah,
and incredibly accessible, but yet new information that I mean, it's hard to give Melissa and I a lot of new information about Jane Austen.
Exactly. And, so this, what I thought was fascinating, is he looks at 20 different seemingly insignificant details in Jane Austen's book. So, like, why does the weather matter in Jane Austen? Mm-hmm. Why, like, things like that. And what I got from this book is basically that Jane Austen was even more of a genius than I thought she was.
How is that even possible?
I know. I already had a pretty high opinion of her. But when you look at these tiny little things, nothing in her books are put there as throwaways. Every mm-hmm. little detail actually matters to the story that she's trying to tell. And he talks about how she was really the first author to use indirect prose as a narrative device. Mm-hmm. And she just really was so ahead of her time in what she did. And that's why her books still radiate with people. And like they're mm-hmm. just still as important to people as they are, because they are just, the writing is brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
So
I would agree.
Yeah. So if you are a Jane Austen fan, now this being the year of the 205th anniversary of her birthday, I think mm-hmm. it's a good year to, you know, go back to all Jane Austen and mm-hmm. look at some other things about Jane Austen. If you haven't kind of delved more deeply in past just reading the novels, I think this is a good time to do it. And this is a like perfect book, because I got to the end of this book and I was like, oh my God, I need to read Jane Austen now. Mm-hmm. Like,
which is what, yeah. Cause we have read some fairly academic works in yeah. our Jane Austen book club, and some of them have been good and some of them have been a lot of conjecture.
Yeah. And like, this doesn't make any like crazy leaps in logic. Like mm-hmm. nothing he's saying is out of the realm of possibility. Like, I mean, it's just, this is someone who knows Jane Austen, teaches Jane Austen, loves Jane Austen, and just understands.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yes. And has actually read all the books.
Multiple times.
Yes.
So yeah, he just does a really great job. So it's What Matters in Jane Austen by John Mullen.
Excellent. Well, so I, in my other little books that I read, I picked up a arc that was given to me, which actually does not come out until March of 2025. So it is current. It's not like 8 years old.
Yeah.
So The River Has Roots, and it is a debut novel. But it is by an author who has written a novel with someone else.
Yeah, so, I mean, so a debut solo novel.
Yes. and it's, I'm going to get you to help me pronounce the name.
I think it is Amal El-Motar,
mm-hmm.
Who was one of the co-authors of This Is How You Lose the Time War.
Yeah, and which I haven't read, but now I'm going to have to go back and read, because I really enjoyed this book. It's called The River Has Roots. And it's really more of a myth fairy tale kind of bound together. In reading why they wanted to write this book, there's a folk song that they really loved, but it had two sisters who ended up pitted against each other because of the love of a man. And so he decided to switch the story and make the sisters closer and kind of make the man more of a villain who's trying to come between two sisters instead of the strife between the sisters. But it's,
well, Lord help the mister who comes between me and my sister.
So the two sisters are Esther and Isabel, and they live by a river that flows from the fairy world to their world. And they tend to these willow trees, which they call the professors. And the willow trees have magic, inherent magic in them. And the two girls sing to them, which helps, which is what their family has done for generation upon generation. And that helps the willows to bring more magic into the world and helps their trees and the willow wood and everything that they use from the willows become more magical and have more power. And so Isabel is the oldest sister. No, Isabel is the youngest sister. Esther is the older sister. And Esther is being courted by someone who she is not interested in. And she has actually fallen in love with someone from the fairy town, which is, you know, not what her family was hoping for. And Isabel is like, well, if you don't want this guy, maybe he's for me. And the story goes from there. Mm-hmm. And it's a very slim volume, so I can't really tell you more than that without ruining the story for
well,
you.
Well, it's published by Tor.com, and yeah. Everything that Tor.com does, like, is a smaller book, but there's so
it's
much
so dense
in
and
it.
Packed.
Yeah, yeah. They amaze me. Like, everything I've read that publisher puts out is just... It's so well done.
And it's kind of like when you start reading Shakespeare, because it's told in this sort of very mythological way, mm-hmm. that you have to get into the language and figure out how things work in this world. But it gripped me from the beginning, and it's lyrical, but it's also got this whimsy in it, but it also has its roots in this magical world, and it was just wonderful. And bittersweet, but very good. And it's really about the love of the sisters, but also the love of family and the choices we have to make to save those we love. Mm-hmm. The really hard choices. And when it comes out in March, I would highly recommend it, especially if you're a fan of This Is How We Lose the Time War.
Yeah.
It is, it's just wonderful. So
good.
So the last one that I have is actually the book that we did for our FOMO book club this month, and it's called The Resurrectionist by A. Ray Dunlap. And so with our FOMO book club, we try and for each month pick a book that has come out like the month before, mm-hmm. basically. So it's like new things. And I will say... It's hard for January to pick books for FOMO because not a lot of stuff is published in December. It's mm-hmm. just sort of a lull in publishing. But this one, I was drawn to the cover of this book mm-hmm. because I think it's pretty fantastic, actually.
Can I describe it for you?
So it's like the torso and pelvis of a skeleton. And then it's got like... these roots going through it with flowers. It looks very anatomical drawing, sort of
Victorian steampunk creepy.
Yeah. Yes. It is the story of, so the main character in it is, his name is James. Mm-hmm. He is the third son of a landed family in, mm-hmm. England, and it's in the early 1800s, 1820 at the latest. But he has to obviously have an occupation because mm-hmm. his oldest brother is going to inherit, you know, the estate and everything.
Oh, the second son.
This is the third son.
Oh,
so
worse.
Second yeah. son has gone into the military and he's like, I have no desire for that. Mm-hmm. And doesn't want to be in politics.
Priesthood?
Well, so that's initially where he decides to go. So mm-hmm. he's going to Oxford and he's studying to be a member of the clergy. Mm-hmm. And he's been there about a year and he discovers just a love of anatomy and anatomy mm-hmm. books and medicine. And is like, you know what? I would like to become a surgeon. Like that mm-hmm. is what I would like to do. And his family is actually
They're okay with it?
Surprisingly okay. On board. They're like, you know what? Okay. So he decides that he is going to go to Edinburgh, which is basically the hub of of surgical education, right? Mm-hmm. So he goes, enrolls in the university in Edinburgh. He gets there, ends up in terrible lodgings, this really gross boarding house situation.
Are there rats involved?
Well, it doesn't say that, but it implies. But he meets there three other guys who are also studying medicine. And it becomes clear to him how little he knows about the system and all of the stuff, because they inform him that, you know, going to the university is great, but you're not going to learn anything unless you go to one of these private surgical schools that have popped up all around Edinburgh. And there's like 12 of them, and they teach you in the Parisian method of anatomy, which is everybody gets their own cadaver and they're dissecting. And, you know, so he decides he's going to join one of these surgical schools as well. And then he finds out that his father, who has died, has left the family with huge gambling debts. Yeah. And so his family doesn't have money to pay his tuition and upkeep and all of this stuff anymore. So they send him a letter telling him that he needs to come home. They have figured out another occupation for him. He's got a job waiting for him with the British East India Company, and he'll be in commerce.
Yes.
And he has no desire to do this. So he's scrambling and trying to figure out a way to stay at the school. And so he goes to the lab assistant and was like, okay, so can I work out a deal where I work for you and get reduced tuition or free tuition? And he was like, yeah, sure. So there's a problem with you. You're staying in this particular boarding house. It overlooks the churchyard of this church. There's been a problem with people robbing graves. Can you, we're trying to figure out if the sexton is on the take and is helping people. So I need you to just keep watch and keep watch of what the sexton's doing. When the sexton is out patrolling in the churchyard, put a lantern in your window. And then when he's not, remove the lantern. He's like, okay, I can do that. Well, it turns out
I see a problem with this.
It turns out that they're not trying to see if the sexton is on the uptake, because he's actually the head of a gang that is grave robbing. And he explains, once James figures this out and he explains it to him, he's like, look, the only people according to law that can be used as cadavers for dissection are people who have been killed as capital punishment for crimes they've committed.
Right.
And he's like, there are literally like four of those a year. Where do you think all of the cadavers are coming from to feed all of these schools, which are 12 of them? They each have like 20 students in them.
Yeah.
You do the math. So he's basically robbing graves to provide these cadavers, right? And so he's like, you know, there's good money in it. So James becomes one of these
guys.
And so then the story goes from there, and I'm not sure if she intended this to have a little bit of a mystery to it, because Burke and Hare come into it, and if you know anything about Burke and Hare, it's not a mystery, like like, you know. So, but if people don't know that, I don't want to ruin it for them, but yeah, so I didn't read it as there being any sort of mystery involved in it. I just read it as, you know,
a good book,
you know, this is what's going on. It was atmospheric. Like when he's talking about Edinburgh, having been there, like, and just sort of the sooty blackness of everything in Edinburgh. Cause it is sooty and black.
It is. I mean, it's a beautiful city.
It is a beautiful city.
But it's old.
It is very old. The uneven cobblestones.
The architecture is heavy. It's It is a beautiful
and
city,
all the
though.
Closes. Yeah. And yeah, so it is. She does a really good job of describing the atmosphere of Edinburgh, which I really enjoyed. I thought it was interesting for people who would be interested in like science and that kind of stuff at the time. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, there I do think she is accurate and did her research. But I just enjoyed it. Like, I mean, it is a low stakes
and it's out now.
Yeah. It's out now. It came out in it came out on Christmas Eve, in fact.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. That's quite a debut time.
Indeed. Yeah. So it's, yeah. Like I said, low stakes, just kind of a good, easy read.
Very good. Well, I have decided to continue on my Lord Peter Wimsey kick.
Oh, sure.
With Dorothy Sayers. And I am thoroughly enjoying it. So I just finished listening to the second one in the series, Clouds of Witnesses, which...
Clouds or clowns?
Clouds.
Okay.
Clouds of Witnesses.
I was like, because I don't want to read a book with clowns.
No, it doesn't have any clowns in it at all. No, it's a biblical title, actually.
Hence my confusion.
So, anyway. Yes, yeah, so it is... So Lord Peter has gone away after solving the last mystery, and he's been in... Elba and Corsica and some other interesting places. And he is suddenly drawn home because his brother, the Duke of Denver, has been accused of murder.
Murder.
Most foul. It's a shooting. So he quickly gets home to kind of see what's up. His brother's like, it's none of your business and you shouldn't be a detective anyway. That's disgraceful. And he's like, no. We're going to take care of you. So it goes from there. It's really fun. So and this is all at the beginning. There's a shooting that's taken place at this hunting lodge. They're all out hunting in the country. At 3 o'clock in the morning, Mary and almost at the same time, Mary is Lord Peter's sister, who's also there with her fiance, Captain Dennis Cathcart. And at 3 o'clock in the morning, the Duke is coming back in from a walk on the moors, which he will not say anything more about. And he trips over this body, which is in the door of the conservatory. And Mary also happens to be going out at 3 in the morning for some undisclosed reason. She couldn't sleep. And she sees her brother leaning over the body of her fiance, who is dead and has been shot. And says, what have you done, sort of. And anyway, he gets accused of murder because it's his revolver, it's his house. He had had an argument earlier with the fiancé because the fiancé had been accused of cheating at cards and making a living by it, which is the most disgraceful thing for a gentleman. Mm. And obviously someone who can't marry his sister at this point. So Mary's already had an unfortunate engagement to an anarchist.
Like you do.
Like one does. And which her family is also deemed entirely unsuitable.
That is shocking.
And but the said anarchist.
But cheating at cards, that is
Well, that's capital. Like that's it.
That is a step too far.
Yeah. So Wimsey comes in to investigate. Charles Parker, Inspector Parker, also comes in. He ends up forging a friendship with Mary. It has the usual suspects in it. I actually really enjoyed this one because Sayers drops the clues all the way through, and it reminded me of what you were saying about Emma. But I picked up on, I was like, ah, like I kind of figured it out, or at least part of it, about halfway through, and I was like, I see where we're going. And it was a lot of fun to take it to its conclusion from there and see how they worked it out. So the murder may not have happened exactly as I thought it would, but the things that made people innocent were all there. So you knew who didn't do it, which was a lot of fun. So I think each one of these, and I've started listening to the third one, and I think each one is a little bit better than the last, mm-hmm. almost, and I'm really enjoying this series. It's a nice diversion. I've been listening to The Granddaughter, which I'll talk about on the next one because it's too much to go into today, by Bernard Schlink, which I'm really enjoying, but it's very dense and fairly dark and goes into a lot of German politics between East and West Berlin and also the ultra-right folk movement in Germany.
Sorry, the ultra-right folk movement just makes me think of, like, cuckoo clocks.
Well,
and it's, later.
Yeah, well, that is it. They go back and they have these folk rallies and they go back to the traditions and the homeland and they celebrate the virtues of all things German.
Yeah, sure.
Including everybody wearing authentic German gear at them. So it should make you think of that because that's part of what it's all about. Anyway, I'm going to save it for next time, but.
All right. Well,
so a cloud, clouds of witnesses, not clowns, clouds.
Yes.
Big difference.
All right. So you were saying you are reading right now the
Granddaughter.
The Granddaughter. Mm-hmm. So I'm right now reading, I am almost finished with it. I have like 20 pages left. It was, well, okay, let me rewind really quickly. Mm-hmm. I have finished The Lord of the Rings.
Oh, well, we both have finished The Lord of the Rings. I with tears because I was sad it was over. Melissa with tears of joy.
Yeah. Woo. I have done it.
Yes.
I can say that I've done it. Mm-hmm. I don't ever need to go back.
I will probably reread it again in 5 or 10 years.
And
yeah.
The fact that there were any instances of the word "and" left in the English language for any other author to use is frankly astounding.
Okay.
So right now, as I said, it is the 250th anniversary of Jane Austen's mm-hmm. birthday this year on December 16th. So I was like, I need something completely different mm-hmm. after The Lord of the Rings. So I am reading out loud all of the Jane Austen books mm-hmm. for me and my husband, which is great because he's only ever read 3 of the 6 of them. Mm-hmm. So 3 of them will be completely new for him, including Sense and Sensibility, which we are reading right
yeah,
now.
Nice.
He had never read. He's seen the movies, but right. he's never read Sense and Sensibility. But in addition to that, I'm reading this book that I picked for like where we do, my husband and I do our little sci-fi mm-hmm. fantasy book club together. The book that I picked this time was part of MIT Press is doing this series of radium age science fiction books. And so it's basically set books that were science fiction kind of published around like the 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say this one is not, I wouldn't say it's sci-fi. It is definitely dystopian. Mm-hmm. So I think that's where this comes from. But it is called The Napoleon of Notting Hill. And it was written by G.K. Chesterton, mm-hmm. who is best known for his Father Brown mysteries.
Yes.
Right. And so that is all I knew of him, that he was like a studied philosophy,
so many different
and
things,
theology. Yeah. But this is only one of several books that he wrote kind of as a, like, about near future England. But mm-hmm. this was the first one. And so in it, it's set about 100 years in the future, and England no longer has a like king determined by family.
Mm-hmm.
It's random, so they just have a list of people, and they're like, oh, this guy is going to be king, and they change it ever so often. And so the king is essentially like a despot at this point and has, mm-hmm. you know, complete rule. And so it starts out with these 3 guys walking along, and one is completely ridiculous. Like he's making jokes that make no sense, but he thinks he's hilarious and mm-hmm. he's just a weirdo. He gets picked to be king.
Oh, perfect.
Sure.
And wow. let me think on that for a minute.
Yeah.
What could go wrong? There
are a few moments in this book where they're kind of talking about despotism, mm-hmm. and I was like, kind of dying inside.
Yeah.
But he decides as his first act as being king that each of these neighborhoods in London mm-hmm. are going to be their own countries now. So Notting Hill is its own thing, and they have gates, and they, you know,
what could go wrong?
He makes a provost of each of these places, and he's drawn, like, it talks about him on the floor with markers and stuff, drawing out flags for them and their ceremonial robes. So
I'm sorry, but this is cutting a little too close to home.
So he's got all these different
mm-hmm.
neighborhoods, right? And like they have like halberds, like mm-hmm. that they're carrying as their ceremonial weapons and all this stuff. So anyway, go forward a little bit, and there's three different provosts of different neighborhoods that want to buy a property in Notting Hill so they can build a roadway. Mm-hmm. And the provost of Notting Hill is having none of it. Mm-hmm. And eventually war breaks out.
They throw like sticky buns at each other.
It's actually pretty
brutal.
Yeah. It actually is pretty brutal. But it's also ridiculous, and mm-hmm. it's obviously satire. But yeah, it's a weird book. And I would say that I like the story. I find mm-hmm. it interesting. I don't love the writing. And when I say I don't love the writing, I don't like the writing at all.
Well, I feel like it's a particular type of British who's right around the same time as Tolkien and all of that, that's just not your style of writing. And so me, as the lover of run-on sentences and all of that, I really enjoy that writing because it's kind of how my brain works.
It's not the same kind of writing as Tolkien. Okay. No, it's not that.
And I've read Chesterton and enjoyed him. It's been a while. I read the Father Brown, a couple of them, a few years ago, like 10 to 15 years ago. But yeah.
I'd be curious because this is the only thing I've ever read mm-hmm. by him. I was not really drawn to priest-centered mysteries.
We have different backgrounds in that area.
But yeah, it's a
weird little book.
It's a weird little book.
Have you ever read any of C.S. Lewis's science fiction?
No, the only C.S. Lewis I've read is
his science Narnia fiction books are interesting.
Yeah,
They're probably a little more Christian-centered. I mean, they're more obviously Christian-centered than the Narnia books, so...
No, those are pretty obviously Christian-centered.
You know, he didn't go light on the allegory there.
No.
He used a rather heavy hand, if you will.
Yeah, I was like, if they're heavier on that, I'm not sure I really want to read them.
I enjoyed them, but yes. Also on the Jane Austen, our next book, I'm also reading Captain Wentworth's Diary, mm-hmm. which is the story told from Captain Wentworth's point of view, and I'm really enjoying it. It's so interesting and fun, and the author does a great job. It's Amanda Grange of not, like, she puts you in the world, but she doesn't try to use language that makes it awkward, so you feel like you're in the story. But it's just very smoothly written.
Yeah, and she does. She has a whole series of those where she kind mm-hmm. of reimagines the story from the male perspective, mm-hmm. like the, you know, mm-hmm. main hero.
So far, I'm really enjoying Captain Wentworth's impressions and discussions of Sir Elliot, Sir Walter Elliot.
Well, sure.
Pretty fabulous. I mean, it's fun. You see him from within, kind of, when you're in the Jane Austen persuasion. But to see him from an outside point of view mm-hmm. initially is a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, so then February for our book challenge that we're doing, our prompt mm-hmm. is a book that features a library or a bookshop.
Oh,
yes.
Well, the granddaughter is going to work for that because he is a bookseller and owns a bookshop.
Mm. I am going to read The Bookshop, which is like a history of like the bookshop yeah. and bookselling. And I can't recall the author's name off the top of
my head.
I've got
a really
right
nice copy from England upstairs. If
yeah.
You're
yeah. Well, no, I have a really nice copy of it as well. Yeah, that's the one that I'm going to do because, you know, may need to learn about bookselling.
Maybe. All right.
Anyway, so if you are participating in the reading challenge and reading along with us, be sure to either fill out the little template thing that we have on Instagram or make a list of them or just, you know, however you want to keep track of it, whatever is easiest for you. But make sure that you do post about it and tag us in it.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you'll be eligible to win a gift card at the end of the year where our winner for 2024 was very excited.
Yes.
And
happy reading.
Yeah, happy reading. And we'll see you on the other side of February.